good afternoon. It's Rod McClure here with our Monday afternoon book reading. And we'll be starting off on Dickens's Nicholas Nickleby, which I think you'll find rather interesting. In fact, having pre-read some of it, very interesting, as a matter of fact. But until then, a word from the people who help make our little station possible.
Braidwood Community Bank, your local community bank supporting your local community. For friendly, helpful advice on general banking, investments, home loans, personal loans, retirement and superannuation and insurance, contact Braidwood Community Bank on 4842 1700.
And they're open 9:30 to 4:30 on weekdays. The branch will now be closed on Saturdays.
A proud sponsor of Braidwood FM.
Long-term Braidwood FM sponsor, Hockey's Braidwood, have a tilt tray that has a capability to carry 20-foot shipping containers and anything around 12.5 tonne. Hockey's can also supply you with bulk water deliveries, gravel, and they have a Kanga Mini for hire. You can phone the office on 4842 2286 or Stephen Hockey on 0429 422 286.
Holdfast Distillery is Braidwood's first distillery, located in the basement of Braidwood Hotel at 180 Wallace Street. Their products are made with Australian grain and are distilled in their specially designed still to produce clean and crisp products. They select the best botanicals grown in Australia or sourced from overseas, ensuring there is no compromise in their products. Call 0406 083 963 for opening hours. Holdfast Distillery, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
Specialising in rural conveyancing and succession planning, Chamberlain's Law Firm are with you for all your legal needs. No matter how big or small, their lawyers can assist with a range of legal problems and advice. With offices in Braidwood, Canberra and Sydney, they have team members everywhere to assist you. Call Chamberlain's today on 6188 6200 or find them online at chamberlains.com.au to speak with their expert lawyers about your legal needs. Chamberlain's Law Firm, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
A big thank you to our sponsors, as I say. Without them, our little station would not be possible. Well, Nicholas Nickleby, we are about to start to read a Dickens book, and one I think listeners will find, well, I hope, as interesting as I do. The Life and Adventures of Nicholas Nickleby. Chapter 1 introduces all the rest. There once lived, in a sequestered part of the county of Devonshire, one Mr. Godfrey Nickleby, a worthy gentleman, who, taking it into his head rather late in life that he must get married, and not be young enough or rich enough to aspire to the hand of a lady of fortune, had wedded an old flame out of mere attachment, who in her turn had taken him on for the same reason. Thus, two people who cannot afford to play cards for money sometimes sit down to a quiet game for love. Some ill-conditioned persons who sneer at the life matrimonial may perhaps suggest, in this place, that the good couple would be better likened to two principals in a sparring match, who, when fortune is low and backers scarce, will chivalrously set to for the mere pleasure of the buffeting. And, in one respect indeed, this comparison would hold good. For, as the adventurous pair of the Fives Court will afterwards send round a hat and trust to the bounty of the onlookers on for the means of regaling themselves, so Mr. Godfrey Nickleby and his partner, the honeymoon being over, looked wistfully out into the world, relying in no inconsiderable degree upon chance for the improvement of their means. Mr. Nickleby's income at the period of his marriage fluctuated between 60 and 80 pounds per annum. There are people enough in the world, heaven knows, and even in London, where Mr. Nickleby dwelt in those days, but few complaints prevail of the population being scanty. It is extraordinary how long a man may look among the crowd without discovering the face of a friend, but it is no less true. Mr. Nickleby looked without discovering the face of a friend, till his eyes became sore as his heart. No friend appeared, and when growing tired of the search, he turned his eyes homeward, he saw very little there to relieve his weary vision. A painter who has gazed too long upon some glaring colour refreshes his dazzled sight by looking upon a darker and more sombre tint. But everything that met Mr. Nickleby's gaze wore so black and gloomy a hue that he would have been beyond description refreshed by the very reverse of the contrast. At length, after 5 years, when Mrs. Nickleby had presented her husband with a couple of sons, and that embarrassed gentleman, impressed with the necessity of making some provision for his family, was seriously revolving in his mind a little commercial speculation of insuring his life next quarter day, and then falling from the top of the monument by accident, there came one morning by the general post a black-bordered letter to inform him how his uncle, Mr. Ralph Nickleby, was dead. Indeed, had left him the bulk of his little property, amounting in all to £5,000. As the deceased had taken no further notice of his nephew in his lifetime than sending to his eldest boy, who had been christened after him on desperate speculation, a silver spoon in a Morocco case, which, as he had not too much to eat with it, seemed a kind of satire upon his having been born without that useful article of plate in his mouth, Mr. Godfrey Nickleby could at first scarcely believe the tidings thus conveyed to him. On examination, however, they turned out to be strictly correct. The amiable old gentleman, it seemed, had intended to leave the whole of his estate to the Royal Humane Society, and had indeed executed a will to that effect. But the institution, having been unfortunate enough a few months before to save the life of a poor relation, to whom he paid a weekly allowance of 3 shillings and 6 pence, he had, in a fit of very natural exasperation, revoked the bequest in a codicil, and left it all to Mr. Godfrey Nickleby, with a special mention of his indignation, not only against the society for saving the poor relation's life, but against the poor relation also, for allowing himself to be saved. With a portion of this property, Mr. Godfrey Nickleby purchased a small farm, near Dawlish in Devonshire, whither he retired with his wife and 2 children, to live upon the best interest he could get for the rest of his money, and the little produce he could raise from his land. The 2 prospered so well together that when he died some 15 years later, some 5 after his wife, he was enabled to leave to his eldest son, Ralph, £3,000 in cash, and to his youngest son, Nicholas, £1,000 and the farm, which was as small a landed estate as one would desire to see. These 2 brothers had been brought up together in a school at Exeter, and, being accustomed to go home once a week, had often heard from their mother's lips long accounts of their father's sufferings in his days of poverty, and of their deceased uncle's importance in his days of affluence, which recitals produced a very different impression on the 2. For while the younger, who was of a timid and retiring disposition, gleaned from thence nothing but forewarnings to shun the great world from the often repeated tale, the 2 great morals went the other way to Ralph the elder, for he deduced that riches are the only true source of happiness and power, and that it is lawful and just to compass their acquisition by all means short of felony. And, reasoned Ralph with himself, if no good came of my uncle's money when he was alive, a great deal of good came of it after he was dead, inasmuch as my father has got it now and is saving it up for me, which is a highly virtuous purpose. And going back to the old gentleman, good did come of it to him too, for he had the pleasure of thinking of it all his life long, and of having envied and courted by all his family besides. And Ralph always wound up these mental soliloquies by arriving at the conclusion that there was nothing like money. Not confining himself to theory, or permitting his faculties to rust, even at that early age, in mere abstract speculation, this promising lad commenced usurer on a limited scale at school, putting out at good interest a small capital of slate pencil and marbles, and gradually extending his operations until they aspired to the copper coinage of this realm, in which he speculated to a considerable advantage. Not only did he trouble his borrowers with abstract calculations of figures or references to ready reckoners, his simple rule of interest being all comprised in the one golden sentence, 2 pence for every half penny, which greatly simplified the account and which was, as a familiar precept, more easily acquired and retained in the memory than any known rule of arithmetic, cannot be too strongly recommended to the notice of capitalists, both large and small, and more especially of money brokers and bill discounters. Indeed, to these gentlemen, justice, many of them are to this day in the frequent habit of adopting it, with eminent success. In the like manner did young Ralph Nickleby avoid all those minute and intricate calculations of odd days which nobody who has worked sums in simple interest can fail to have found most embarrassing, by establishing the one general rule that all sums of principal and interest should be paid on pocket money day, that is to say, on Saturday, and that, whether a loan were contracted on the Monday or on the Friday, the amount of interest should be in both cases the same. Indeed, he argued, and with great show of reason, that it ought to be rather more for one day than for five, inasmuch as the borrower might in the former case be very fairly presumed to be in great extremity. Otherwise, he would not borrow at all with such odds against him. This fact is interesting as illustrating the secret connection and sympathy which always exists between great minds. Though Master Ralph Nickleby was not at that time aware of it, the class of gentlemen before alluded to proceed on just the same principle in all their transactions. From what we have said of this young gentleman, and the natural admiration the reader will immediately conceive of his character, it may perhaps be inferred that he is to be the hero of the work which we shall presently begin. To set this point at rest for once and forever, we hasten to undeceive them and stride to its commencement. On the death of his father, Ralph Nickleby, who had been some time before placed in a mercantile house in London, applied himself passionately to his old pursuit of money-getting, in which he speedily became so buried and absorbed that he quite forgot his brother for many years, and if at times a recollection of his old playmate broke upon him through the haze in which he lived, for gold conjures up a mist about a man more destructive of all his old senses and lulling to his feelings than the fumes of charcoal, it brought along with it a companion thought that if they were intimate, he would want to borrow money of him. So Mr. Ralph Nickleby shrugged his shoulders and said things were, they were better as they were. As for Nicholas, he lived a single man on the patrimonial estate until he grew tired of living alone, and then he took on to wife the daughter of a neighbouring gentleman with a dower of £1,000. The good lady bore him 2 children, a son and a daughter, and when the son was about 19 and the daughter 14, as near as we can guess, impartial records of young ladies' ages being, before the passing of the new Act, nowhere preserved in the registries of this country, Mr. Nickleby looked about him for the means of repairing his capital, now sadly reduced by the increase in his family and the expenses of their education. "Speculate with it," said Mrs. Nickleby.
"Speculate, my dear?"
said Mr. Nickleby, as though in doubt.
"Why not?"
asked Mrs. Nickleby.
Because, my dear, if we should lose it," rejoined Mr. Nickleby, who was a slow and time-taking speaker, "if we should lose it, we shall no longer be able to live, my dear."
"Fiddle," said Mrs. Nickleby.
"I'm not altogether sure of that, my dear," said Mr. Nickleby.
"There's Nicholas," pursued the lady, "quite a young man. It's time he was in the way of doing something for himself. And Kate too, poor girl, without a penny in the world. Think of your brother. Would he be what he is if he hadn't speculated?"
That's true," replied Mr. Nickleby. "Very good, my dear. Yes, I will speculate, my dear."
Speculation is a round game. The players see little or nothing of their cards at first starting. Gains may be great, and so may losses.
The run of luck went against Mr. Nickleby. A mania prevailed. A bubble burst. 4 stockbrokers took villa residences at Florence. 400 nobodies were ruined. And among them, Mr. Nickleby.
"The very house I live in," sighed the poor gentleman, "may be taken from me tomorrow. Not an article of my furniture, but will be sold to strangers."
The last reflection hurt him so much that he took at once to his bed, apparently resolved to keep that at all events.
"Cheer up, sir," said the apothecary.
"Oh, you mustn't let yourself be cast down, sir," said the nurse.
Such things happen every day," remarked the lawyer.
"And it's very sinful to rebel against them," whispered the clergyman.
"And what no man with family ought to do," added the neighbours. Mr. Nickleby shook his head, and motioning them all out of the room, embraced his wife and children, and having pressed them by turns to his languidly beating heart, sunk exhausted on his pillow. They were concerned to find that his reason went astray after this, for he babbled for a long time about the generosity and goodness of his brother, and the merry old times when they were at school together. This fit of wandering past, he solemnly commended them to one who never deserted the widow or her fatherless children, and smiling gently on them, turned upon his face and observed that he thought he could fall asleep. Chapter 2. Of Mr. Ralph Nickleby and his establishment and his undertakings, and of a great joint stock company of vast national importance. Mr. Ralph Nickleby was not, strictly speaking, what you would call a merchant. Neither was he a banker, nor an attorney, nor a special pleader, nor a notary. He was certainly not a tradesman, and still less could he lay any claim to the title of professional gentleman, for it would have been impossible to mention any recognised profession to which he belonged. Nevertheless, as he lived in a spacious house in Golden Square, which, in addition to a brass plate upon the street door, had another brass plate 2 sizes and a half smaller upon the left-hand doorpost, surmounting a brass model of an infant's fist, grasping a fragment of a skewer, and displaying the word "office," it was clear that Mr. Ralph Nickleby did, or pretended to do, business of some kind, and the fact, if it required any further circumstantial evidence, was abundantly demonstrated by the diurnal appearance between the hours of 9:30 and 5 of a sallow-faced man in rusty brown, who sat upon an uncommonly hard stool in a species of butler's pantry at the end of the passage, and always had a pen behind his ear when he answered the bell. Although a few members of the graver professions live about Golden Square, it is not exactly in anybody's way to or from anywhere. It is one of the squares that have been, a quarter of the town that has gone down in the world and taken to letting lodgings. Many of its first and second floors are let furnished to single gentlemen, and it takes boarders besides. It is a great resort of foreigners. The dark-complexioned men who wear large rings and heavy watch-guards and bushy whiskers, and who congregate under the opera colonnade, and about the box-office in the season, between 4 and 5 in the afternoon, when they give away the orders, all live in the Golden Square, or within a street of it. 2 or 3 violins and a wind instrument from the opera band reside within its precincts. Its boarding houses are musical, and the notes of pianos and harps float in the evening time round the head of the mournful statue, the guardian genius of the little wilderness of shrubs in the centre of the square. On a summer's night, windows are thrown open, and groups of swarthy, mustachioed men are seen by the passer-by, lounging at the casements and smoking fearfully. Sounds of gruff voices practising vocal music invade the evening silence, and the fumes of choice tobacco scent the air. There snuff and cigars and German pipes and flutes and violins and violoncellos divide the supremacy between them. It is the region of song and smoke. Street bands are on their mettle in Golden Square, and itinerant glee singers quaver involuntarily as they raise their voices within its boundaries. This would not seem a spot very well adapted to the transaction of business, but Mr. Ralph Nickleby had lived there notwithstanding for many years, and uttered no complaint on that score. He knew nobody round about, and nobody knew him, although he enjoyed the reputation of being immensely rich. The tradesmen held that he was a sort of lawyer, and the other neighbours opined that he was a kind of general agent, both of which guesses are as correct and definite as guesses about other people's affairs usually are, or need to be. Mr. Ralph Nickleby sat in his private office one morning, ready dressed to walk abroad. He wore a bottle green spencer over a blue coat, a white waistcoat, grey mixture pantaloons and Wellington boots drawn over them. The corner of a small plaited shirt frill struggled out, as if insisting to show itself from between his chin and the top button of his spencer, and the latter garment was not made low enough to conceal a long gold watch chain composed of a series of plain rings which had its beginning at the handle of a gold repeater in Mr. Nickleby's pocket and its termination in two little keys, one belonging to the watch itself and the other to some patent padlock. He wore a sprinkling of powder upon his head as if to make himself look benevolent, but if that were his purpose, he would perhaps have done better to powder his countenance also, for there was something in it, very wrinkles, and in his cold, restless eye, which seemed to tell of cunning that would announce itself in spite of him. However this might be, there he was, and he was all alone. Neither the powder, nor the wrinkles, nor the eyes had the smallest effect, good or bad, upon anybody just then, and are consequently no business of ours just now. Mr. Nickleby closed an account book which lay on his desk, and throwing himself back in his chair, gazed with an air of abstraction through the dirty window. Some London houses have a melancholy little plot of ground behind them, usually fenced in by four high whitewashed walls and frowned upon by stacks of chimneys, in which there withers on, from year to year, a crippled tree that makes a show of putting forth a few leaves late in autumn, when other trees shed theirs, and, drooping in the effort, lingers on all cracked and smoke-dried till the following season, when it repeats the same process, and perhaps, if the weather be particularly genial, even tempts some rheumatic sparrow to chirrup in its branches. People sometimes call these dark yards gardens. It is not supposed that they were ever planted, but rather that they are pieces of unreclaimed land, with the withered vegetation of the original brickfield. No man thinks of walking in this desolate place, or of turning it to any account. A few hampers, half a dozen broken bottles, and such like rubbish may be thrown there, for when the tenant first moves in, but nothing more, and there they remain until he goes away again, the damp straw taking just as long to moulder as it thinks proper, and mingling with the scanty box and stunted everbrowns and broken flower pots that are scattered mournfully about, prey to blacks and dirt. It was into this place, a place of this kind, that Mr. Ralph Nickleby gazed as he sat upon his hands in his pockets looking out the windows. He had fixed his eyes upon a distorted fir tree, planted by some former tenant in a tub that had once been green and left there years before to rot away piecemeal. There was nothing very inviting in the object, but Mr. Nickleby was wrapped in a brown study and sat contemplating it with far greater attention than, in a more conscious mood, he would have deigned to bestow upon the rarest exotic. At length his eyes wandered to a little dirty window on the left through which the face of his clerk was dimly visible. That worthy, chancing to look up, he beckoned him to attend. In obedience to this summons, the clerk got off the high stool, to which he had communicated a high polish by countless gettings off and on, and presented himself in Mr. Nickleby's room. He was a tall man, of middle age, with two goggle eyes, whereof one was a fixture, a rubicund nose, a cadaverous face, and a suit of clothes, if the term be allowable, when they suited him not at all, much the worse for wear, very much too small, and placed upon such a short allowance of buttons that it was marvellous how he contrived to keep them on. "Was that 12:30, Noggs?" said Mr. Nickleby, in a sharp and grating voice. "No more than 25 minutes by the Noggs was going to add public house clock, but recollecting himself substituted a regular time.
My watch has stopped, said Mr. Nickleby. I don't know from what cause.
Not wound up, said Noggs.
Yes, it is, said Mr. Nickleby.
Overwound, then, rejoined Noggs.
That can't very well be, observed Mr. Nickleby.
Must be, said Noggs.
Well, said Mr. Nickleby, putting the repeater back in his pocket, perhaps it is.
Noggs gave a rather peculiar grunt, as was his custom at the end of all disputes with his master, to imply that he, Noggs, triumphed and, as he rarely spoke to anybody unless somebody spoke to him, fell into a grim silence and rubbed his hands slowly over each other, cracking the joints of his fingers and squeezing them into all possible distortions. The incessant performance of this routine on every occasion, and the communication of a fixed and rigid look to his unaffected eye, so as to make it uniform with the other, and to render it impossible for anybody to determine where or at what he was looking, were two among the numerous peculiarities of Mr. Noggs, which struck an inexperienced observer at first sight.
"I'm going to London Tavern this morning," said Mr. Nickleby.
"A public meeting?" inquired Noggs.
Mr. Nickleby nodded.
"I expect a letter from the solicitor respecting that mortgage of Ruddle's. If it comes at all, it'll be here by 2 o'clock, delivery. I shall leave the city about that time and walk to Charing Cross on the livery. I shall leave the city then. So, if there are any letters, come and meet me and bring them with you."
Noggs nodded. As he nodded, there came a ring at the office bell. The master looked up from his papers and the clerk calmly remained in a stationary position.
The bell, said Noggs, as though in explanation.
At home?
Yes.
To anybody?
Yes.
To the tax gatherer?
No. Let him call again.
Noggs gave vent to his usual grunt, as much as to say, "I thought so," and, the ring being repeated, went to the door, whence he presently returned, ushering in by the name of Mr. Bonney, a pale gentleman in a violent hurry, who, with his hair standing up in great disorder all over his head, and a very narrow white cravat tied loosely round his throat, looked as if he had been knocked up in the night and had not dressed himself since.
"My dear Nickleby," said the gentleman,
taking off a white hat, which was so full of papers that it could scarcely stick upon his head.
"There's not a moment to lose. I have a cab at the door. Sir Matthew Pupker takes the chair at 3, and members of Parliament positively are coming. I've seen two of them safely out of bed. The third was at Crockford's all night. He's just gone home to put a clean shirt on and take a bottle or two of soda water, and will certainly be with us in time to address the meeting. He's a little excited by last night, but never mind that. He always speaks the stronger for it."
"It seems to promise pretty well," said Mr. Ralph Nickleby,
whose deliberate manner was strongly opposed to the vivacity of the other man of business.
"Pretty well," echoed Mr. Bonney. "It's the finest idea that has ever started. United Metropolitan Improved Hot Muffin and Crumpet Baking and Punctual Delivery Company. Capital 5 millions in 500,000 shares of £10 each. Why, the very name will get the shares up to a premium in 10 days.
"And when they are at a premium?" said Mr. Ralph Nickleby, smiling.
"Ah, when they are, you know what to do with them as well as any man alive, and how to back quietly out at the right time," said Mr. Bonney, slapping the capitalist familiarly on the shoulder. "By the by, what a very remarkable man that clerk of yours is."
"Yes, poor devil," replied Ralph, drawing on his gloves. "Though Newman Hoggs kept his horses and hounds once."
Aye,
said the other carelessly. "Yes," continued Ralph, "and not many years ago either, but he squandered his money. Invested it anyhow, borrowed at interest, and in short, made first a thorough fool of himself and then a beggar. Took to drinking and had a touch of paralysis, and then came here to borrow a pound, as in his better days I had."
"Done business with him," said Mr. Bonney with a meaning look.
Just so," replied Ralph.
"I couldn't lend it, you know."
"Oh, of course not. But as I wanted a clerk just then to
open the door and so forth. I took him out of charity. He's remained with me ever since. He's a little mad, I think, said Mr. Nickleby, calling up a charitable look. Oh, but he's useful enough, poor creature, useful enough. The kind-hearted gentleman omitted to add that Newman Noggs, being utterly destitute, served him for rather less than the usual wages of a boy of 13, and likewise failed to mention in his hasty chronicle that his eccentric taciturnity rendered him an especially valuable person in a place where much business was done, of which it was desirable no mention should be made out of doors. The other gentleman was plainly impatient to be gone, however, and as they hurried into the Hackney cabriolet immediately afterwards, perhaps Mr. Nickleby forgot to mention circumstances so unimportant. There was a great bustle in Bishopsgate Street within as they drew up, and, it being a windy day, half a dozen men were tacking across the road under a press of paper, bearing gigantic announcements that a public meeting would be holden at 1 o'clock precisely to take into consideration the propriety of petitioning Parliament in favour of the United Metropolitan Improved Hot Muffin and Crumpet Baking and Punctual Delivery Company, capital 5,500,000 shares of £10 each, which sums were duly set forth in fat black figures of considerable size. Mr. Bonney elbowed his way briskly up the stairs, receiving in his progress many low bows from the waiters who stood on the landings to show the way, and followed by Mr. Nickleby, dived into a suite of apartments behind the great public room, in the second of which was a business-looking table and several business-looking people. "Here!" cried a gentleman with a double chin, as Mr. Bonney presented himself. "Chair, gentlemen, chair!" The newcomers were received with universal approbation, and Mr. Bonney bustled up to the top of the table, took off his hat, ran his fingers through his hair, and knocked a hackney coachman's knock on the table with a little hammer, whereat several gentlemen cried, "Here!" and nodded slightly to each other, as much as to say what spirited conduct that was. Just at this moment, a waiter, feverish with agitation, tore into the room and, throwing the door open with a crash, shouted, "Sir Matthew Pupker!" The committee stood up and clapped their hands for joy, and while they were clapping them, in came Sir Matthew Pupker, attended by two live members of Parliament, one Irish and one Scotch, all smiling and bowing and looking so pleasant that it seemed a perfect marvel how any man could have the heart to vote against them. Sir Matthew Pupker especially, who had a little round head with a flaxen wig on top of it, fell into such a paroxysm of bows that the wig threatened to be jerked off every instant. When these symptoms had in some degree subsided, the gentlemen who were on speaking terms with Sir Matthew Pupker, or the two other members, crowded round them in three little groups, near one or other of which the gentlemen who were not on speaking terms with them, lingering and smiling and rubbing their hands in the desperate hope of something turning up which might bring them into notice. All this time Sir Matthew Pupker and the two other members were relating to their separate circles what the intentions of government were about taking up that bill, with a full account of what the government had said in a whisper the last time they dined with it, and how the government had been observed to wink when it said so, from which premises they were at no loss to draw the conclusion that if the government had one object more at heart than another, that one object was the welfare and advantage of the United Metropolitan Improved Hot Muffin and Crumpet Baking and Punctual Delivery Company. Meanwhile, and pending the arrangements of the proceedings and a fair division of the speechifying, the public in the large room were eyeing by turns the empty platform and the ladies in the music gallery. In these amusements the greater portion of them had been occupied for a couple of hours before, and, as the most agreeable diversions pall upon the taste on a too protracted enjoyment of them, the sterner spirits now began to hammer the floor with their boot heels, and to express their dissatisfaction by various hoots and cries.
These vocal exertions emanating from the people who had been there longest naturally proceeded from those who were nearest to the platform and furthest from the policemen in attendance, who, having no great mind to fight their way through the crowd, but entertaining nevertheless a praiseworthy desire to do something to quell the disturbance, immediately began to drag forth by the coat-tails and collars all the quiet people near the door, at the same time dealing out various smart and tingling blows with their truncheons, after the manner of that ingenious actor, Mr. Punch, whose brilliant example, both in the fashion of his weapon and its use, this branch of the executive occasionally follows. Several very exciting skirmishes were in progress, when a loud shout attracted the attention, even of the belligerents, and then there poured onto the platform from a door at the side a long line of gentlemen with their hats off, all looking behind them and uttering vociferous cheers, the cause whereof was sufficiently explained when Sir Matthew Pupker and the two other real members of Parliament came to the front amidst deafening shouts and testified to each other in dumb motions that they had never seen such a glorious sight as that in the whole course of their public career. At length and at last, the assembly left off shouting, but Sir Matthew Pupker being voted into the chair, they underwent a relapse which lasted 5 minutes. This over, Sir Matthew Pupker went on to say what must be his feelings on that great occasion, and what must be that occasion in the eyes of the world, and the wealth and respectability of his honourable friends behind him, and lastly, what must be the importance to the wealth, the happiness, the comfort, the liberty, the very existence of a free and great people, of such an institution as the United Metropolitan Improved Hot Muffin and Crumpet Baking and Punctual Delivery Company. Well, so starts Nicholas Nickleby. What an interesting story. Isn't it amazing that stock markets, the greatest casinos on the face of the earth, were around then too, along with charlatans, usurers, shysters and con men? The punctual delivery crumpet and hot baked biscuit. My God. Well, we will see where it all goes next week, no doubt. Until then, keep well, Braidwood.